Good morning, everyone. Today we are blessed to be sitting here with Secretary Mike Gill. So welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
So Mike, your experience and your success is pretty well documented, but I'd like to read some of these highlights really quick because I really want to make sure all of our listeners really know what's going on.
Now, don't overdo it. Keep it simple.
Well, yeah, never mind. So Secretary Mike Gill is a business leader with 4 decades of experience as an entrepreneur. Do you tell everyone that? 4 decades?
That's a bunch.
It is.
Gosh, they'll be better than saying 5 decades.
Absolutely. Well, recently, most recently, you really led the transformation of Maryland's economic development, which is rebranded, I believe, was the Department of Commerce.
No, Department of Commerce.
Yep. You also began your career back in 1974 at IBM, where you served as an account manager, a regional specialist. You did a lot in the sales school. You were an instructor there, which is fantastic. You know, teaching people a skill set is one of the most fulfilling things for me personally, so I'm sure you enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Then you most recently, you went to Evergreen, where you're a principal. Evergreen is an M&A and capital raising organization totaling over $5 billion in value for publicly traded companies. So that's incredible as well. You earned your bachelor's degree, business administration, from Towson University. Go Tigers. I went there as well. And you're also awarded an honorary doctorate of, humane letters degree from Towson.
Yeah. Dr. Gill.
Dr. Gill.
Everybody's a doctor these days.
I love it. Absolutely love it. What I know you most for, honestly, is your experience as a public servant with the governor, Governor Hogan. And you really transformed a lot of what the state of Maryland did, specifically for businesses. And being a business owner, that was a big thing for me. So, as I said, a lot of your experience is documented. And what we find is when it's documented as well as it is, a lot of people look at us and they call us, you know, rainmakers. And it seems like everything we touch turns to gold almost immediately. But I think we all know that there are struggles from time to time. And sometimes it's even those struggles and some of those failures that really shape who we are. And it really, you know, determines how we proceed and how we achieve some of that success over time. So when you look back at your experience, you know, starting at IBM, then founding Americom, and then the investment firms, and then all the way up to Secretary of Commerce, you know, what are some of those things that really shaped who you are as a businessman?
We are sort of an amalgamation of experiences, aren't we?
Starting at birth. That's right.
I'm very much a local kid. I grew up in Timonium, one of 4 children. Father's a small businessman. mother was a homemaker. Very normal growing up life. Went to a really cool grade school called Mount Washington Country School. It was military. Yeah. It was Sisters of Mercy. I called them Sisters of No Mercy. they were tough, and it was a very, very normal life. Got to Calvert Hall early on in my Calvert Hall days. There were hardships in our family, so all of a sudden, for the very first time, going from a really special growing up childhood to some hardships that were a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, our mother ended up taking a job at Rada Balls Florist. She was making $2 an hour.
Wow.
Four young kids, you know. I'm a sophomore at Calvert Hall, but I can't explain it, Steve. But through the adversity, instead of it bringing me, you know, into a shell, in some ways, I just dealt with it. I dealt with what was going on in our family. I finished at Calvert Hall. I remember being a freshman at Calvert Hall and getting my first job at Manor Care Nursing Home on Joppa Road, washing dishes.
Yeah,
but I remember reading something that said, hey, if you're going to wash dishes, be a great dishwasher. So yeah. I was probably 14 and getting my first paycheck. But things work out.
Oh, they do.
Things work out. Family got back to a better place, and I finished at Calvert Hall and then off to Clemson.
So when you were in Calvert Hall and then you went to Clemson, which, by the way, I think you had a baseball scholarship,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have any idea what you wanted to be when you grew up? Was this some kind of a great plan?
You know, that's funny. I used to go back and forth between, do I want to be a member of the Beach Boys or pitch for the New York Mets?
Well, how's your singing voice?
I can't exactly explain to you why I used to always say the Mets as opposed to the Orioles. But, I mean, that was sort of when you're 17 or 18, my brain at that point didn't go much further than do I want to be part of the Beach Boys or do I want to be a pitcher for the Mets? I didn't make it to either one. I know all the Beach Boys songs, and I did get a chance to throw baseballs, but that's as close as it got.
Well, you know what? Brian Wilson was an amazing musician. So
a little crazy, but a lot of talented people are crazy, aren't they?
They are. There is that fine line there.
Yes.
I think actually he was writing psychedelic music right before the Sgt. Pepper's album came out for the Beatles. Yeah. And the Beach Boys thought he was crazy, which is just interesting to me.
did you want to be a Beach Boy too after you heard about it?
I did, but it was a different type of Beach Boy. You know, so you really didn't know when you were in high school or college?
No. I gravitated to when there were opportunities to be in some type of a leadership role.
Okay.
Whether it was when I was a student at Clemson and a fraternity I was part of, or student government that I got connected with. And I was, for a period of time, I wasn't a leader on the baseball field, but I was sort of a leader relative to just things associated with our baseball team.
Got it.
But I think I always just wanted to, if I was going to be part of something, I always wanted to be able to have an impact on what it was we were going to try to do. So if that's some type of definition of leadership, maybe that's what I was gravitating to at an early age.
Got it.
Yeah.
It's funny you mention that, that the idea of leadership through sports. I've heard from a lot of business people over the years that they find high-level athletics really prepare people for leadership roles, and they prepare them for success in their careers over time. Now that you've had a chance to really look back on it and you have that perspective, do you think that's true?
I think quite possibly. I mean, when I think, which by the way, to get it in perspective, for those who might watch this cool podcast with you and I, people have said to me, well, at Clemson, were you any good? What was your best pitch? I'd get that once in a while. What was your best pitch? Because I was a right-handed pitcher. And I would pause and I'd say, anything that got close to home plate was my best pitch. And so when we think about sports, it's connectivity to who we are, whether sports gave us an additional step towards preparing us for what was to come later, starting a company in 1984, Americom, in the cellular industry, my role in government, Evergreen Advisors. And I was thinking about it, and I thought to myself, well, I guess you do learn a lot about yourself when the bases are loaded, and then you've got a 3-0 count on the. You probably learn to deal with adversity.
Yes, you do.
But again, sports, loved it. Played sports at Calvert Hall, baseball at Clemson. It's team. It's preparation. It's giving your best.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
giving your best all the time.
You know, one of the things I learned through baseball, and I, growing up, I loved the Orioles. My family was a huge baseball fan.
Yep.
And I think more so than anything else, baseball taught me how to fail. and maybe that's because I wasn't very good. I don't know. But the point is, when you're standing at the plate and you're missing 75% of the pitches, right? And you're only on base at the best, 30% of the time.
Yeah.
It really tells you and teaches you that, you don't have to be perfect. And it teaches you how to improve. And I'm sure you felt that way too.
Yeah,
about
for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But again, your success with your businesses, there is no failure listed. And I'm sure that's by design.
Nothing's linear.
No.
In business. Nothing.
Nothing.
The key is when the road, I heard an expression a long time ago, at least when you see a sign that says roadblock, there's a road on the other side.
That's right.
But again, every time the road turns, you adjust.
That brings me to my next point. Yeah, Do you think... the entrepreneurs that jump into business right out of high school like I did, do you think they're so prepared, or do you think they have a mindset that they won't fail because they really don't know what awaits?
No, I think good news, bad news. It's why most entrepreneurs fail, is they really don't understand what they're getting into.
Got it.
And quite often, they could be this close to success, But the journey was so hard to get to that. And they didn't know they were that close. The journey was so hard getting to there that they said, I'm done. Hmm. I mean, I got to find a real job. I got to get a real paycheck. When they might have been that close.
Yeah.
So again, whether it's being an elected official for the first time and being responsible for Baltimore.
Yeah.
And you've never done that before.
Yeah.
You know, and do you really understand the challenges and then how to deal with them? Or it's going to be like an experience.
Yeah.
That you hope you're going to be able to adjust and make an impact. So whether it's an entrepreneur, whether it's being mayor of a city, whether it's a little leaguer being on the mound for the first time, it's all experiences. Yep.
So when you founded Americom,
yep.
Did you feel like you were in that path that you may have been close to success, but you didn't really know? Like,
holy cow!
Tell me what life was like back then.
Yeah, I was going to say I may ask you to write the foreword for me if I ever put a book together on Americom, because it'd be a pretty good book. No, Americom, 1984, the beginning of the cellular telephone industry.
Yep.
Met an individual through Ernst & Winnie days, started a company. We got an SBA loan of $230,000. Mm. We each put $30,000 of our own money in, which I didn't have. I found a banker friend, and I convinced him to give me $30,000 that I didn't deserve, and he did. And then he made me promise that I was going to pay it back one day, or he'd be in a lot of trouble. So net-net, we started a company called Americom, cellular telephones,
yeah.
Hiring young men and women to go out and knock on doors and sell car phones.
So this was 1984?
1984, right in the very beginning.
Wow.
There probably weren't 25,000 people in the country at that point that had a cellular telephone.
Wow.
The partnership didn't work out.
No.
I had two banks that we borrowed money from. You do what you often do when you start a business, and that is you pledge everything you have.
Yeah.
And all I had was a house. You know, what I owed the banks was probably three times greater than my net worth. So I would laugh it off. I mean, one time I went out to dinner with my wife on a Friday night, and because the partnership was over, the two banks, they weren't pleased. Wow. They wanted their money back. It's 1986. We're doing what we have to do. So I'm out with Mary. It's a Friday night. I've got it on autopilot to get Americom to, number one, survive, and then number two, hopefully have a chance to be great. So we're at the corner stable out on York Road. And she looks at me and she says, can we really lose the house? Huh. And I thought, this is an easy question. I can give her a whole lot of gibberish on this one. But I was kind of tired. So I said, yeah, we can lose the house. Hmm. She screamed loud, jumped up. The whole restaurant was packed. Everybody's staring at us. Wow. And I could hear somebody say, I think he asked for a divorce. And so here I am. I'm reaching in my pocket. She's screaming. I'm reaching in my pocket. I'm throwing money at the waitress. Here, whatever you need, take it all. And out we went.
Oh my God.
I went and saw an accountant friend and a good buddy and took my financials with me. And because we were in a difficult place.
Yeah.
I said, hey, Dick. Look at my financials. What do you think? The partnership I was in is over, and now we're trying to stabilize. What do you think, Dick? Look at my financials. It took him about a minute. He goes, I think you're bankrupt. I went, no, what do you really think?
Wow.
I still think you're bankrupt. I said, he says, if I were you, I'd file Chapter 7, save your butt as best you can. You know, keep your house, because I don't think the banks are going to take it. But that's what I would do. And I said, Dick, it's not an option. Wow. I didn't know why it wasn't, but I said, it's not an option. So we dug down. We never quit. We kept the right attitude. We had about 35 people in the organization, 35 team members. Then I got a big break. Verizon Wire, or Bell Atlantic Mobile, who we represented, called me up and said, hey, we're going to start opening up these Bell Atlantic mobile phone centers throughout the Mid-Atlantic. The first one we're going to open, it's going to be on Aylesbury Road in Timonium, up near where you guys
yeah.
are. We'll have the lease on the building. We'll have the front end of it, selling phones. We want you to do all the service work, because we had a service organization. You do all the service work. Well, within 5, 6, 7 years, that beginning with Aylesbury grew to 1,000 people,
yeah.
1,100 people, 1,200 people. We were in service. We were in car repair, phone repairs. And all of a sudden, you know, things changed.
Yeah.
But part of it was you just never quit.
That's right.
You got to be honest with yourself, but you never quit because you just don't know how close you might be to turn the corner.
No, absolutely.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and that, that's the point of it. You never quit. You never quit. And Matt, back to what you said earlier.
And by the way, it all worked out in the year 2000. A Fortune 500 company, $8 billion in revenue and 75,000 employees, you know, acquired my company.
Absolutely.
And
it's a huge success.
But in 1986 at the Charred Rib on that Friday night, we were far away from Pleasantville.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I've never had to have that conversation with my wife, but it probably wouldn't go well either. So you had that huge success with Americom, and then what you said, you know, the private sector is too easy now. I got to go into the government sector and see if I can fix politics. why did you make that change?
Well, I stayed a couple years with the company that acquired us, and then met up with a friend from the '80s, Rick Corr, who in 2000 had founded a firm called Evergreen Advisors. It was early stage, doing advisory services, beginning to do some investment banking activities. And 2007, I caught up with Rick, and he said, "Hey, I'd love you to get involved with what we're doing." So I became his partner, he said, "Look, you should have a title. So you be chairman," which means nothing, but you be chairman. And so I joined Rick.
Okay.
And then Governor Hogan in 2014, a week before the election. Washington Post said he was going to lose by 19 points, and he won by 5. And that was 2014.
Yeah.
And it was soon after that that I got a phone call from one of his folks who said, "You ever thought about being Secretary of Commerce?" And I said, "Not on my radar screen." And then the process began.
Yeah. So when you jumped into Secretary of Commerce, I remember the rebranding of Maryland very clearly. In fact, I remember the first time I heard you speak as Secretary of Commerce, and you mentioned, I don't know if you mentioned it or if you just started doing it, but you started calling the taxpayers the customers.
Yeah.
And that really stuck with me because that wasn't just a change in verbiage. That was an entire cultural shift of how the public sector really looked at the taxpayers, and you know, how did you do that? That's not an easy thing.
Well, to back up quickly, so the governor wins in 2014. I meet with him probably 3 weeks later in his transition office in Annapolis, and he said, "Look, I ran on Change Maryland. We've been going in the wrong direction for too long, and we had to get the brakes on and begin to move in a different direction," where business mattered, economic development was important, you know, to growing jobs, to creating tax revenues that in turn allow us to do more things for more people. And I took with him, small story. So when I went to see him and he started talking about Change Maryland and I really want you to do this, I took him a copy of my favorite book, The Little Engine That Could. And people would say, "Little Engine?" I said, "Are you kidding me? That's the greatest book ever written."
Yes, sir.
Waddy Piper, 1928, determination, hustle, never quitting, optimism, helping others. That's The Little Engine.
It is.
I took a copy of the book with me, gave him an autographed copy. And literally, I wrote inside of it, and we looked at each other, and I wrote inside of it, "Open for business." And we both said, "Open for business."
Yep.
And then it was within the next year or so that we actually created the brand around Open for Business.
Yep.
But the customer question, here's how that came about. I'd been in the job for maybe a month, and I'm reading an article. So this is January of 15, and I'm reading an article that says there's 500,000 businesses in Maryland who have a tax ID. And they're everything from the big boys that we all know, like Lockheed Martin and the Marriott Corporation, and McCormick, of course, and many other big guys. But then there's a lot of little guys. By the way, probably 85% to 90% are little guys. It's a dressmaker, a dress shop on Baltimore Avenue in Cumberland, Maryland, with two employees.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm reading the article and I thought, what do they all have in common, all 500,000? They're customers. They're not taxpayers. They're customers. And if you have a customer, you say to them, thank you very much for your business. How can we help you?
That's right.
So it stuck in my head, a culture of yes. We created a commerce sub-cabinet where we had six agencies that we got together and we said, culture of yes, that's what we're going to be. And it caught on. And even though taxes are taxes and regulations are regulations, they do impact businesses. What I really learned from all of that, Steve, is that attitude would really go everywhere from a positivity standpoint if businesses felt that government was their ally and not their adversary.
Yeah.
Because they always thought of government as just, businesses would say to me, Mike, before you know, you and Hogan and everybody else showed up as a business, we just didn't want government to hurt us.
That's right.
You know, I mean, to help us would be like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
We just didn't want them to hurt us.
I remember feeling that way.
So the culture, yes, was really about how can we help you? Yeah. And what I learned is I've learned throughout my entire lifetime, a positive attitude. See, the positive attitude releases all the right things in your brain that allow you to be creative, allow you to be optimistic, allow you to get to come up with more options. So then when a business would say, I need your help, 8 out of 10 times, we could help them. It wasn't that hard. The ninth one, maybe a little harder, maybe take a little longer. The 10th one, sorry, that one can't be addressed right now. But 8 out of 10, yeah. So it caught on.
Yeah. Well, and it did. And I remember it clear as day. I remember that first time I heard you speak in that role.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed with it. So you look back, you've had so many different experiences. You've had so many successes, obviously some challenges here and there. You know, I think you've got 9 months, maybe 10 months left in this role until the end of the term. Is that
right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it didn't see it coming. When I told you I didn't see it coming when I got the phone call 7+ years ago. Didn't see this one coming either, all of a sudden, here I am. I called, now I can say first time around was chapter one.
Yeah.
Now I'm in chapter two. It's just going to be a shorter chapter.
Yeah.
So the race, in November, there'll be a new governor in Maryland. In January, that new governor will be sworn in Annapolis. And somewhere around mid-January, I guess I get my last paycheck.
So I've got
something like that.
So I've got one last thing I'm really curious about.
Yep.
I personally define success as having relationships, understanding that there's a sense of fulfillment in life and helping others. And, that's where I get my sense of fulfillment. And there's a lot of different definitions. But at the end of the day, where do you get your fulfillment and how do you see success?
You know, it's funny. It evolves, obviously, as you get older. I find that I put near the top of the list helping others to achieve, accomplish, get something that's important to them, whatever it might be. I mean, I just realized that little step. I mean, it's a small item I do every year. This time of year, there's a lot of wonderful kids that want to go to great schools like Clemson, you know, and Maryland and Towson and University of Virginia. And I know all the schools well. And they reach out to me about writing a letter of recommendation. And I meet with these children and try to learn something about them. And, you know, for me, it's a small effort to help this 18-year-old to maybe achieve something that they want so badly, and then they're off and running for their career. So I think part of fulfillment is helping others get what it is that's important for them, and how I can use my experiences, my background, my relationships, all the above. So that's probably one form of fulfillment.
Excellent. Is that what's on the horizon? Is that what you're going to do for the next few years after this role?
Well, my wife did give me the green light for this 12 months. I haven't pressed my luck any to say, oh, she'll let me do this. Maybe she'll let me do this. I think to get the 40, you know, the goal in marriage, I want to get 47 to 48. we've got 8 awesome grandchildren. They're sort of spread out between Notre Dame Prep, and there's a Loyola Middle School in there.
Yeah.
And I do have one of the grandsons targeted for Calvert Hall. I got to get somebody over to the hall. So I think that'll take place. But for now, I'm loving what I'm doing. I'm glad to be back. I'm addicted to the word yes. So somewhere in the future, there'll be another, you know, Mike, would you consider such and such? I have gotten better though, at least taking a deep breath before I say yes.
Got it.
So I'll try to do that.
Addicted to the word yes. Yep. Like that. So for all you investors out there, you know where he is. All right, Mike. Well, thank you so much for
joining
us today. It's always a pleasure to sit down
with
you.
Thanks, Steve.
And I hope we can have you again soon.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Appreciate it. Keep doing great things.
Thank you.